Okay, let's get into it. You asked us for a deep dive on, well, some of the most worrying financial signals out there, specifically global volatility and country risk for 2025-2026. And I think if you've been feeling like there's some turbulence ahead, your instincts are spot on.
Oh, absolutely. The sources we've looked at, they really paint a stark picture. Underneath what looks like a stable global economy, there's this massive mounting wave of debt, external and increasingly internal.
So what's our mission today?
It's pretty straightforward, really. We need to break down what actually triggers a debt crisis, pinpoint the biggest weak spots around the globe, and then ask the big question, is all this sovereign debt even sustainable? Or are we, heading for some kind of major reckoning?
And just to set the stage here, the scale is, it's kind of staggering. You have to look at it historically. We're talking about sovereign debt, that's for advanced and emerging economies combined at levels that are near all-time highs. I mean, when you adjust the numbers, the financial stress globally is comparable to like World War I or World War II. It's that serious.
It's wild, because we weren't supposed to be here. After the 2008 financial crisis, everyone expected this painful period of deleveraging, countries cleaning up their books.
But that's not what happened.
Not at all. Instead, public debt ratios just kept climbing, almost unabated. And now all that accumulated debt has collided with a huge shift in the global cost of money.
You mean interest rates, the rising borrowing costs?
Exactly. Since 2020, they've just shot up. You can see it clear as day in the 10-year bond yields for the US, the UK, Germany. So you have this dangerous combination. The pile of debt is at a record high, and the price to service that debt is climbing fast. That's the headwind for the next couple of years.
Okay, so that's where this gets really interesting. If a crisis is coming, we need to know what it looks like. Where does the rot actually start? You mentioned this idea of a homemade crisis. How does a country go from, healthy growth to financial ruin all on its own?
Well, what's fascinating is that the sources all kind of agree on the starting point. It's almost deceptively simple. It starts when a nation's consumption exceeds its savings.
So the whole country is living beyond its means.
That's it. The country as a whole is absorbing more goods and services than it produces or saves.
Which means you have to import the difference or borrow to pay for it. And that leads directly to the famous twin deficits.
Precisely. You get a budget deficit, government spending more than it taxes, and a current account deficit, which is importing more than you export. All that excess demand creates huge inflationary pressure. The central bank starts burning through its foreign currency reserves to keep things stable, capital starts to flee, and, well, panic sets in.
And that's the cycle. It ends in a balance of payments crisis and eventually a default.
That's the classic internal combustion engine of a crisis, yeah.
But it's never that pure, is it? What are the specific red flags? The things that tell us a country is getting close to that tipping point? How do you separate the homemade mess from the external shocks?
The homemade ones are what you'd expect. Sudden political turmoil, coups, inflation, that's just out of control. And of course, those huge, persistent budget and current account deficits, a drop in national savings is a huge one too. It means your domestic buffer is just gone.
And the external world pushing a country over the edge.
Yeah, the exogenous shocks, those are so much harder to prepare for. Think about a major war disrupting trade, or a sudden global recession, so no one's buying your exports. Or what's happening right now, a continuous rise in global interest rates. A rating agency downgrade can trigger immediate capital flight and the currency mismatch.
Right, where you owe money in dollars but earn it in your local currency.
And then the dollar suddenly gets stronger and your debt burden just explodes overnight. It can sink a nation.
This all seems to boil down to the core mechanics of sustainability. How do we judge, objectively, if a country can actually handle its debt?
This is maybe the single most important metric in all of sovereign finance. And it's all about the relationship between two things: the interest rate on the debt, R, and the rate of economic growth, G.
The famous R versus G equation.
That's the one. For a country's debt to be stable, the cost of borrowing, R, cannot consistently be higher than the rate your economy is growing, G. It's that simple. When your interest payments outpace your growth, your debt just grows explosively. Even if you're balancing your budget on everything else, that condition, R greater than G, it's unsustainable.
And with rates rising and growth slowing down, a lot of countries are staring at that exact problem right now.
For the first time in years, yes. And you have to factor in the primary deficit too, how much you borrow before interest. and your reserves, your cash on hand. If those are low, any shock becomes a crisis instantly.
Okay, let's shift from theory to just the raw numbers. We need to grasp the sheer volume here. How big is the global debt pile we're talking about for 2025?
We are looking at over $102.1 trillion in total global government debt. The number itself is almost meaningless. It's so big. But what's more important is the concentration. Just three countries account for over 60% of that total.
So who are the big three?
The United States, by a huge margin. They hold about 34.55% of all global government debt. China is next at 16.12%, and then Japan with just over 10%. When you have that much debt concentrated in the world's biggest economies, it means any stress in Washington or Beijing. It sends shockwaves through the entire system.
And we see these scary-looking debt-to-GDP ratios all over the advanced economies. You always hear about Japan, but Greece, the UK, Italy, the US, they're all carrying these massive loads, especially after the pandemic.
Right, but this creates a kind of paradox. Because while the numbers look awful, the actual risk is very structural. This is where who you owe the money to matters way more than the total number. Because of capital market globalization, you have investment funds and rating agencies who are now, you know, firmly in the driver's seat.
So it's one thing to owe money to your own central bank and a totally different thing to owe it to a bunch of fast-moving global funds.
Exactly. Look at Japan. The debt-to-GDP ratio is sky high, but their default risk is pretty low. Why? Because the Bank of Japan holds almost half of the bonds. Foreigners only hold about 7%. Now, compare that to countries like Cyprus or Austria, Ireland, even France. They have really high foreign ownership. That means if global sentiment turns against you, the capital flight is immediate. It's destabilizing.
We should also touch on the emerging markets, because the old story was always that they got into trouble with foreign debt, with dollar debt. But the sources show that's changing.
Yes, that is a huge shift in the risk landscape. Between 2000 and 2021, the share of domestic debt in emerging markets went from 31% to 46%. Mm. So a debt crisis isn't just about external debt anymore. Now it's off of this complicated mess of external liquidity problems and internal stress from servicing local debt at high rates.
So let's move to the flashpoints. Where is the risk already, you know, boiling over? We know some debt is already in default.
The current amount of sovereign debt in default is about $425 billion. So we have ongoing crises in places like Ecuador, Argentina, Zambia. But the really crucial information for you listening is who's next, the candidates for 2025.
Which countries should we be watching?
The sources are flagging Tunisia, South Africa, Ecuador again, and Belarus. These are countries showing signs of acute default risk. And if you look at the vulnerability rankings, Turkey is number one, Egypt is number two, Tunisia is up there to number four. They're facing immediate problems.
And there's this specific problem in Africa, what's being called the bond debt wall. Why is that causing so much concern?
The problem is really twofold. First, you have a rising share of private creditors, bondholders, in the debt of the poorest countries. And these creditors are fragmented. They're motivated by short-term gains. And this has created a huge amortization wall where massive repayments are all coming due right now between 2024 and 2026, especially in Africa.
And then you have China. The opacity, the secrecy around their loans just adds this whole other layer of complexity.
It's a huge roadblock. When a country defaults, everyone needs to know who is owed what and on what terms so you can negotiate a fair deal. But China, as a major lender, often keeps its loan terms confidential. So when Ghana goes to the negotiating table, the other creditors, they don't know if they're getting a fair shake.
And the exposure is massive. Ghana owes China over 31 billion, Guinea almost 22 billion, Ethiopia nearly 15 billion.
These huge opaque loans just make the whole restructuring process incredibly difficult. Precisely. If one big creditor won't take a haircut, then nobody else wants to either. And the whole thing just stalls while the country's economy spirals.
Okay, what about the last line of defense, liquidity? A country's foreign exchange reserves, its cash buffer, how do those look?
Well, looking at FX reserves relative to short-term debt is a great indicator. And the contrast is fascinating. Some emerging markets are way better prepared than advanced economies. India has reserves covering 427% of its short-term debt. China, 399%. Mexico, 334%.
Those are huge cushions. Now, what about some of the advanced economies?
Contrast that with Italy at 5%. Or the UK at just 2%. Now, this doesn't mean the UK is about to default, but it shows a totally different philosophy. A low reserve ratio means they have way less room to maneuver if there's a sudden capital outflow. They're much more dependent on global confidence.
Let's look at a couple of case studies to see how these things play out. First, Ukraine's crisis back in 2015.
Ukraine in 2015 was the textbook crisis. It was geopolitical, it was domestic, widening deficits, a deep recession, the currency collapsed, their external debt hit 131% of GDP, and their reserves were almost gone. They had, as you say, hit the wall.
So how did they get private creditors to agree to a deal when the future was so bleak?
Yeah, it was a really innovative restructuring. They negotiated a 20% write-off on $18 billion in bonds. But the sweetener was a GDP-linked instrument. Basically, investors took the loss up front, but they'd get a future payout if Ukraine's economy grew faster than 4% between 2021 and 2040.
So it aligned everyone's incentives. It was a bet on recovery.
Exactly. But even so, their financials were looking worse right before the 2022 invasion. Their debt service ratio, so the annual payments versus their exports, it jumped from 47 to 83%. The market panic was obvious. The cost to insure their debt, the CDS spreads, they blew out to 10,000 basis points. That's the market screaming that default is basically inevitable.
Now let's contrast that with Greece. Greece still has one of the highest debt-to-GDP ratios in the world, but somehow its situation has improved. Why is that?
Greece is a fantastic example of shifting the focus from the stock of debt, the huge total, to the manageable flow, the annual cost. And their situation has improved because of institutions like the European Stability Mechanism, the ESM.
What did the ESM actually do?
The ESM now holds about 55% of Greece's public debt. And here's the critical part. The debt has an average maturity of 31 years, and it's at super low fixed interest rates. This means Greece isn't constantly trying to roll over its debt at today's high rates. The annual cost is low and predictable for decades, which basically removes the immediate risk, even with that huge headline number.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this and tracking global risk? We've seen that it all comes down to R being greater than G. What are the levers that countries can actually pull right now to stabilize things?
Well, there are really only three, based on the math. You either have to reduce your average interest rate, R, which is tough right now. You have to increase your GDP growth, G, or you have to boost your primary budget surplus, which is a nice way of saying you have to tax more and spend less.
And you can put a hard number on that, right? A clear target.
Absolutely. The rule is your fiscal deficit has to be less than your debt to GDP ratio multiplied by your GDP growth rate. So in simple terms, if your debt is 85% of GDP and you're growing at 2%, your deficit has to be less than 1.7% of GDP. It's a clear, quantifiable target.
Which brings us full circle. Global borrowing costs are rising. And crucially, emerging markets have built up these huge piles of domestic debt. Their exposure has shifted from external banks to their own internal financial systems.
That's the key nuance from the sources. That's the risk you should be tracking.
So here's the final thought. Given that dynamic, the rise of domestic debt, the rising cost of borrowing, is the primary threat to financial stability, now less about that classic external default crisis we saw in the 80s and 90s? And is it more about the interplay between massive internal debt and crushing internal interest rates? It really suggests the whole geometry of risk has shifted, forcing us to look past the raw numbers and into the structure of the debt itself. That's the real deep dive for the years ahead.